So our passage this evening is Judges chapter 19 verse 1 through to chapter 20 verse 11. Now there are three main episodes or scenes in this passage. The first takes place in Bethlehem, where this Levite has gone in order to reclaim his estranged concubine. The second takes place in Gibeah, where this Levite, with his reclaimed concubine, has stopped off for a night on the way home. And then the third episode or scene, it takes place at Mizpah, where the tribes of Israel have gathered at the instigation of this same Levite. So those are the three main episodes. What we're going to do this evening is look at three dominant themes. And those three dominant themes almost divide up neatly one per episode, except that one of the dominant themes kind of straddles two of those episodes or scenes that I mentioned. So we're going to look at hospitality. That's a dominant theme in this passage. And in fact, that's the straddling theme. It's there in the first scene in Bethlehem, and then of course it recurs, this theme of hospitality, in the second scene at Gibeah. So we're going to look at hospitality. We're going to look at sexuality. That's another dominant theme, and it's there of course in the second scene at Gibeah. And then we're going to look thirdly at community. That's the final dominant theme, and that's there in the third scene at Mizpah. And of course, all three of these themes are in themselves good. Hospitality is good. Sexuality is good. Community is good. But as we should expect in these last chapters of Judges, these chapters which are punctuated, you remember, by that refrain, there was no king in Israel. It's there at the beginning of our passage tonight, and I interpreted it last time as ultimately referring to the need for a heart-transforming king. As we should expect in these last chapters of Judges, these inherently good things are here horribly perverted. Let's look then in more detail. First of all, hospitality perverted. Hospitality perverted. The Bible contains some lovely examples, doesn't it, of hospitality. You think of that Shunammite woman who, with her husband, set aside a room in her house for Elisha. It was Elisha's room. He could use it whenever he was passing by, whenever he needed it. Or you think of those two conversion narratives in Acts chapter 16, and you have Lydia converted down by the riverside as Paul converses with her and the Lord opens her heart. And remember how immediately, she's so insistent, isn't she? Immediately having come to Christ, she's so insistent that Paul and Silas and the others should come and stay with her at her house. And then you have the jailer converted and the wonderful way in which he, in the middle of the night, having just come to Christ, takes Paul and Silas back to his house and washes their wounds there. You think of Paul's tantalizing reference in Romans 16 verse 13 to Rufus's mother, who he says has been a mother to me as well. Presumably her house was always open to the Apostle Paul. It was a place where he could be well fed, where he could get his clothes washed, where he could get a bit of TLC whenever he was feeling a bit down in the dumps. And as I say then, there are these lovely examples in the Bible of hospitality. But here in this passage, this beautiful phenomenon has been perverted. How is it perverted? What's wrong with the hospitality on display here? Well, several things. First of all, it's self-promoting. It's self-promoting. And I'm referring here to the first instance we have of hospitality, which occurs then in the first episode. So there's this Levite, we've mentioned him already, and he has this concubine. And for some reason, the concubine deserts him. I don't think we are supposed to understand that she has an affair, as verse 2 could suggest. I think the point is simply that she leaves him, so the going back to her father's house is the unfaithfulness in this case. For some reason then, she goes back home to Bethlehem, and eventually the Levite goes there after her. And the hospitality that we're talking about then is that which is extended to this Levite there in Bethlehem by his concubine's father. And in one sense, I suppose you could say, well, it's fantastic hospitality. It's lavish, isn't it? And relentless. But I think it's fair to say that as a reader, you read this account of the Bethlehemites' hospitality, and you just feel instinctively that it's odd, don't you? It feels strange. Okay, this is the ancient Near East where you wouldn't expect hospitality to consist merely of a cup of tea and a biscuit. But even by ancient Near Eastern standards, it just feels odd. The way that this guy makes it so hard for the Levite and his concubine to leave, to get away. We can't quite put our finger on what he's up to, perhaps, but it just feels odd. And I think we're meant to have that feeling. And I think, too, that our inability to put our finger on what the guy is up to has to do partly with a deficiency in our English translations. Because when you read this narrative in Hebrew, there's a tiny little detail which I think may actually have huge significance. It's this host's last words before he disappears from the pages of Scripture forever. There in verse 9, it's his final plea. Behold, the day has waned towards evening. Please spend the night. Behold, the day draws to its close. Lodge here. Let your heart be merry. And tomorrow you shall arise early in the morning for your journey and go home, our versions read. It's literally in the Hebrew, and go to your tent. And go to your tents. Now, it's possible that this Levite then actually did live in a tent. But if so, his father-in-law hardly needs to draw attention to the matter, does he? It's a bit rude, it's a bit churlish, it's a bit uncivil for him to be drawing attention to the fact. And it's more likely, I think, that the Levite does live in a house, but a house that is much smaller than this one where he's just been enjoying hospitality in Bethlehem. A house where the food isn't as exquisite and where the wine doesn't flow so abundantly. And this is a snide remark then by the host there in Bethlehem. He's saying to the Levite, you can't compete with me. And I think it suddenly opens a window into what this lavish hospitality has been all about. It's been about self-promotion. This guy has simply been parading his wealth and his unrivaled ability to wine and dine his guests. He's been showing off. He's been asserting his own supremacy in this area, which of course was considered so important in the ancient Near East. He's been asserting his supremacy in that area over this Levite. And it reminds us this evening, doesn't it? That reminds us, I suppose, of something that we've considered quite a bit in recent weeks in Matthew's Gospel. That it's possible to do really good things for really bad reasons. I mean, there in Matthew's Gospel in chapter 6, it's been giving and praying and fasting, all good things, but Jesus warns about doing them for really bad reasons. And here then it's hospitality. I mean, hospitality is in itself, in biblical terms, a wonderful thing, isn't it? It's a godlike activity to engage in. You think of all those Psalms which describe God dealing with the believer as a host, extending hospitality. Psalm 23 is the most obvious example. My cup runs over. You anoint my head with oil. God is this host who brings us into his own very home, into the bosom of his family. So hospitality in itself is a wonderful thing, a godlike thing, but it can be perverted. It can become like fasting and giving and praying, a platform for self-promotion. Look at my generosity. Look at my cooking skills. Look, in this case, look at my super-duper setup. My house, the food, the wine, the sumptuousness of it all. We must be so careful, mustn't we? Even the best things, even the most godlike activities, they can so easily be perverted. So it's self-promoting, this hospitality. Secondly, hospitality in our passage, it's cruel. It's cruel. Because in both instances of hospitality that we encounter here, then there's one character, isn't there, that fares very badly. And that character, of course, is this concubine. In the first instance, she's simply sidelined as an irrelevancy, as her father and her husband kind of take center stage. Again, it's the attention to the little details of the narrative that really draw this out. If you look at verse 3, we read that her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her. Now again, it's not entirely clear what the circumstances of the estrangement are. And it seems then, as I say, that she has deserted him, gone back to Bethlehem, to her home family. But this, I think, may well be an indication that it was not without provocation that she deserted him. And that he probably has treated her fairly poorly. And now then, after these 4 months, he is going to her to win her back, to woo her again, to make up for how he had treated her, to speak kindly now to her. But interestingly, in the Hebrew, the phrase to speak kindly is literally to speak to her heart. That's the phrase, to speak to her heart. Now, that word heart is used 4 more times in this scene. Verse 5, the father-in-law says to the Levite, strengthen your heart with a morsel of bread. Verse 6, be pleased to spend the night and let your heart be merry. Verse 8, strengthen your heart and wait until the day declines. Verse 9, let your heart be merry. And you see what's happening here then. This Levite has come to Bethlehem in order to appeal to the concubine's heart, and yet it seems as though that concern gets utterly swallowed up by the host's relentless focus on the Levite's heart. Think about yourself, he's saying over and over again. Think about making your heart glad with good food and good wine. And that's why I say this poor woman there, who should be being entreated by this Levite who has come to woo her again and win her again, instead, she is just being sidelined. And it's the Levite's heart that is being made merry over all this food and drink. But the sidelining in the first scene is, of course, nothing compared to the fate of the concubine in the second instance of hospitality. There she is, and presumably there has been some degree of reconciliation, and she goes back with her husband. They set off. They set off far too late because of the lavishness of the hospitality in Bethlehem. And so on their way back, they have to stop over somewhere, and they end up staying the night in this Benjamite town of Gibeah, where this old man extends hospitality to them. And of course, it all goes very well for a while. It all goes very well, this hospitality, until late in the night, suddenly his house becomes the target of Gibeah's nastiest pieces of work. And they're besieging the house and they're battering the door. And so the host goes to the door and engages with the mob outside. And his approach as he does so is almost unbelievably cruel, isn't it? You can have the concubine. I can't hand over to you my male guest. That's unthinkable. That would be outrageous. I can't possibly do that. But you can have the concubine. She's dispensable. She's expendable. That's the approach he takes. And again, we might just think, well, this is ancient Near Eastern culture. You know, ideas about gender equality in that culture, they just didn't exist. But that would be wrong. This is not an ancient Near Eastern thing in a blanket sense. This is specifically a Canaanite thing. The cruelty that this host displays here toward this poor woman, it was absolutely not the Israelite way of doing things. And if you want a simple demonstration of that, of course, you just have to flick over a couple of pages in your Bible and come to the next book, the book of Ruth, where we have that wonderful man Boaz, whose treatment of Ruth, a foreign woman who was just asking to be exploited, was so different, wasn't it? So noble. And there were men who Boaz was conscious of might go and abuse Ruth, and he makes sure that doesn't happen, and he makes sure that she's treated with dignity and she's fed and she's given everything she needs. And Boaz shows the Israelite treatment of women and the treatment that this old man shows toward this concubine here then. It's Canaanite behavior. And it reminds us, I suppose, that there's more than one way that the Israelites could become conformed to the surrounding Canaanites. I mean, the obvious way here in our passage is this mob. These are Benjamite men. These are Israelite men, and yet they're acting in such a grossly Canaanite way. But this old man, who in some ways is such a likable figure, we like him at first, don't we? He too is also conforming to Canaanite behavior in the way that he treats his male guest as untouchable, but his female guest as just expendable. And I guess that reminds us, doesn't it, that there's more than one way that we can become conformed to the world around us. You know, we use that term worldly. What do we immediately think of? Worldliness. We perhaps immediately think of sexual immorality and greed, obsession with material things, that kind of thing. It's interesting, you go to James chapter 4, and we haven't got time to go there now, but in James chapter 4, James discusses worldliness, he uses that very term. And he's not thinking of any of those things. He's talking about quarreling and arguing between Christians. In other words, you can have an evangelical church where everyone is very modest in their lifestyle, no greed. Everyone is very chaste in their lifestyle, no sexual immorality. And yet there's arguing and splitting up over Bible versions and musical instruments and whatever else it might be. And James is saying to us, that's worldliness too. That's being conformed to the world around. And so we need to be careful. The subtle ways that we can conform. So hospitality in our passage, and it's self-promoting and it's cruel. And then for another thing, it's exaggerated. One of the big questions in this passage is why, following the events in Gibeah, is the Levite so aggrieved with the Benjamites? I mean, why does he go to such lengths to stir up a civil war? That's basically what he does. Why does he do that? Why does he chop up this body? Why does he make sure this big assembly of the Israelites happens? Why does he go to such lengths? Well, you might say it's obvious. They've gone and done what they've done to his concubine. Of course he's going to be aggrieved. But I don't think that's the reason. This guy doesn't care one bit for his concubine, does he? In actual fact, you read the narrative carefully, he's the one that chucks his concubine out the door to the mob. There in verse 25, the man seized his concubine and made her go out to them. It's not the old man that does that. It's him, the Levite. And then he just goes to bed, cool as a cucumber. He's just chucked his concubine out to this mob, and then he just goes to bed, so that we can read in verse 27, in the morning he rose up. And then he's about to go on his way, carry on his journey, having handed her over the night before to this mob. He's not even bothered about where she might be now, what's happened to her. He's about to just set off on his way home until he opens a door and almost trips over her because she's lying on the threshold. It's actually possible that in the end it's him, not the Benjamites, who kill her. Doesn't say, does it, that she's dead lying on that threshold. Just says she's lying there. He tries to speak to her, she doesn't answer. He dumps her on the donkey, goes home, chops up her body. It's possible. A grim thought, but possible that he's the one who kills her. So, if he's not bothered about her then, why does he go to such lengths to stir up this civil war, this war against the Benjamites? Well, again, I think we need to comb the details of the passage. In verses 18 and 19, he's in dialogue with the old man there in the open square in Gibeah. And he's explaining his situation to the old man. And at the end of verse 18, this is what he says. He says, I went to Bethlehem in Judah. I'm going to the house of the Lord. I don't think that's the correct reading. I think the footnote is right there. I'm going home. But no one has taken me into his house. It's a bitter indictment, isn't it? Which you wouldn't really expect him to come out with at this point. He's surely trying to win over the old man. He wants to go and stay in the old man's house, and yet he's saying to the old man, well, your neighbours are a right lousy bunch. No one has given me any hospitality. He seems very bitter about the fact that nobody has opened their home to him until now. Now, of course, that is shocking, because he is an Israelite and someone should have opened their home. But I think this Levite has such an exaggerated view of the importance of hospitality that this to him is some kind of unforgivable slight. And from that moment, he has this grudge against the Benjamites, which subsequently then just uses the fate of the concubine as an occasion to express that grudge and get at the Benjamites. And if I'm right then in that interpretation, it's scary, isn't it? That it's one man's grudge, because he's been denied hospitality, it's one man's grudge that plunges Israel into civil war at the end of the day. Shows how dangerous, doesn't it, an individual's grudges can be. Don't let grudges gain a foothold in your heart. If this Levite's grudge could threaten the unity of a nation, then your grudge, your resentment, your bitterness against somebody or some people could threaten the unity of a family or a church or goodness knows what. Grudges can grow and develop and snowball, as seems to happen with this Levite. So hospitality perverted. But then secondly, sexuality perverted. Sexuality perverted. Because like hospitality then, human sexuality in itself, of course, is a beautiful thing. And it might surprise you to hear this, but I think there's a hint of that even in this passage. As night falls then in Gibeah, out of the woodwork come these horrible men. And it's interesting what they say they want in verse 22. They want to know someone. They want to know someone. It's a term that you'll all be familiar with if you read the Bible much. And we're not to think of that verb know as some kind of prudish euphemism for sexual relations. Rather, I think it captures the reality that sex, according to the Bible, is relational. It's unambiguously relational. You have two persons who commit themselves to one another in an exclusive, lifelong bond, whereby over the months and years and decades, they will get to know each other better and better, each other's strengths and weaknesses, each other's hopes and dreams. They will get to know how each other ticks, what each other is made of, as it were. And their sexual knowing, then, is just, if you like, a picture, an enactment of that deeper knowing that is there between them. It's why such language as casual sex is such a nonsensical concept, isn't it? C.S. Lewis says the monstrosity of sexual intercourse outside of marriage is that those who indulge in it are trying to isolate one kind of union, the sexual, from all other kinds of union, which were intended to go along with it and make up the total union. So I'm saying that word in verse 22, that word know, it gives a little glimpse, I think, of the beauty of human sexuality. It reminds that it's a physical kind of knowing by which two persons express the fact that they know each other in every way. They know each other profoundly in the context of an exclusive lifelong bond. But here, of course, it's been terribly perverted. these men in Benjamin, they may use the right word, but their behaviour is a million miles away from that biblical vision of sex. In that connection, then, let's just notice two things quickly in particular. First of all, the object of their desire. I mentioned just now that horrible concept of casual sex, but of course these men are a step further along the line of sexual depravity. Their desire is for another man, this Levite. And in one sense, of course, as readers, we're supposed to be shocked by this. This has echoes of Sodom, doesn't it? In fact, more than just in the superficial way, if you read the two narratives alongside each other, Genesis 19 and this narrative, there's all kinds of verbal echoes. Clearly, the writer had that in mind. There are horrible echoes here of Sodom. And of course, such an irony that this Levite, he has said back in verse 12, I won't spend the night in Jebus. Why? Because it's not an Israelite city. You don't know what might happen there. And he goes on to this Israelite city and spends a night there and finds it's just Sodom in disguise. So at one level, we're supposed to be shocked here. But in another sense, I think we shouldn't be shocked. One of the main themes throughout this book is Israel engaging in idolatry. And here now at the end of the book, then, we have a town full of Israelite men inflamed with homosexual desire. Now that's not random. That's not arbitrary. Precisely that same connection is there in the New Testament, isn't it? In Romans chapter 1. What precisely is the connection in Romans 1 between idolatry, idol worship, and homosexual behavior? Well, it kind of works in two ways, doesn't it, in Romans 1? If you like, there's a theological connection. Paul teaches there in that passage that when men engage in idolatry persistently and in an entrenched manner, then God, as punishment, gives them over to these kinds of desires. So there's a theological connection between idolatry and homosexual behavior. But there's also, Paul teaches in that passage, a logical connection. Have you ever read Romans 1 and noticed Paul's repetition of the verb exchange? So in verse 23, he talks about people exchanging the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. So there's one exchange in verse 23 of Romans 1, exchanging God for idols. And what's the consequence? Verse 26, for this reason, God gave them up to dishonorable passions, their women exchanged, same word, exchanged natural relations for those that are contrary to nature. You see what he's saying? Paul is saying that this is entirely logical. When people do this utterly unnatural thing of exchange the living, true God who made them for some silly shrine, some silly idol, then their foolish exchanges aren't going to stop there. They will exchange other natural things for unnatural ones. They will exchange natural sexual behavior for unnatural sexual behavior. When you worship in an unnatural way, you will end up behaving sexually in an unnatural way. That seems to be what Paul is saying in Romans 1. Which is why, I suppose, our great need in a society that is more and more pushing the homosexual agenda, our great need is the gospel of Jesus Christ, isn't it? And there are other things that, yes, we can and should do. We should try to protect our schools and complain when this kind of stuff is promoted shamelessly on the media and all the rest of it. But things will only change when people start worshipping the true God. When people worship what is natural to worship, then they will behave naturally in this area. And so our great need is the gospel of Jesus Christ, to tell men and women to abandon their idols and worship the one who really made them. So these Benjamites, then, there's the object of their desire. And then notice too the object of their abuse, because it's not the same thing, is it? The old man, as we've said, he won't throw out the Levite to them, so they settle for the concubine, the woman. It's such a powerful testimony to the power of lust, isn't it? Lust, this frighteningly powerful force that is so kind of irrational, so reckless, that it will kind of seize on anything. They want the Levite, but they'll settle for the concubine instead, even though she's of a completely different gender. But there's just something so irrational about lust that it will just kind of grasp on anything and devour anything. That's, I think, the picture we're getting here. And elsewhere in the Bible, we see the power of lust, don't we? We see it in David, to whom we referred this morning. It drove him not only to do what he did with Bathsheba, but then to even kill a man. You think of Amnon, also in a similar part of Scripture, and the way he was so infatuated with his half-sister. It made him ill, and he behaved so abominably. Lust is a terribly powerful thing, and all of us need to be on our guard. And remember two things, I suppose. Number one, yes, to be on our guard, and to be very vigilant against this thing that can grip us and make us irrational and reckless. But secondly, to remember as Christians that we do have a King who has changed our hearts. And even the most powerful sins are sins that we can fight against and resist. And even lust need not get the victory over us. If we belong to King Jesus, I can do all things through him who gives me strength. Hospitality perverted, sexuality perverted, and then finally this evening and briefly, community perverted. Community perverted. And this then is the third and final scene. So the Levite, as we've said, has, because I've suggested, so aggrieved at the Benjamites for their denial of hospitality earlier, he has gone and cut up his concubine, sent the parts around the land, so that this great assembly takes place at Mizpah. And the last verse, well, indeed, the first verse and the last verse of the section we read in chapter 20 seem so encouraging, don't they? Verse 1 of chapter 20, then all the people of Israel came out from Dan to Beersheba, including the land of Gilead, that's the other side of the Jordan. And the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. And then verse 11, all the men of Israel gathered against the city, united as one man. At last, Israel are acting as a community. We've seen so often throughout Judges, haven't we? Some tribes come out, other tribes stay at home. We've seen that it's been very difficult for anyone to get all the Israelites singing from the same hymn sheet. And yet here at last, in chapter 20, we have the Israelites assembling as one man. And it's not bad in itself, I think, that they are doing. I think we'll discover as we go on that this action against the tribe of Benjamin, although very sad, it does have Yahweh's approval. And the Israelites are right to treat what the Benjamites have done so seriously. To some degree, I think they're duped into this by the Levites. He's not entirely truthful, is he, in the report he gives at this assembly of what's happened. But nonetheless, it is right that they respond and that they call the Benjamites to account. And they do seem to have Yahweh's approval. So it's not in itself such a bad thing that they all assemble as one man in this way here. It's just sad that it's taken this to do it. And it hasn't happened until now. And when they really had even more reason to do it, at earlier points in the book, they didn't do it. And they were so divided. And it's only now, in these very sad circumstances, that finally they will come together as one man. Back in Deborah's day, when there was an enemy occupying the land, she and Barak, they couldn't get them all to come out unitedly. Think of poor old Samson. And he doesn't seem to have any cooperation from the Israelites. In fact, on the contrary, the tribe of Judah is trying to hand him over to the enemy. But here now, when there's a tribe that needs dealing with, now they'll all come out and act as one man. What does it indicate? I think it indicates that their necessary responsibilities excite them more than their glorious privileges. Their necessary responsibilities excite the Israelites more than their glorious privileges. This was a necessary responsibility, as I've said. They did have to deal with the Benjamites. But that seems to get them going and stir their juices more than their glorious privilege. What do I mean by that? Well, back in Deborah's day, when the land was being invaded by an enemy, back in Samson's day, God had raised up a deliverer for them. And this didn't happen in other nations. When an enemy came and conquered the land, no, God raised up a deliverer. But Yahweh did this for Israel because the Israelites were his people, his redeemed people, the people of the Exodus, the people who had freedom now in their DNA. That was their privilege. Freedom, redemption was their privilege. And every time God sent a Barak or a Samson, he was shouting out to them, "You are a redeemed people, a free people who shouldn't settle for life under enemy occupation." But that didn't excite the Israelites half as much as dealing with the Benjamites here now at the end of the book. Their necessary privilege, their necessary responsibilities excited them more than their glorious privileges. Gideon could blow his trumpet and rally the Israelites, and they would half-heartedly come along, some of them, to his side. That can still happen, can't it? It can be evident in churches, building projects, disciplinary proceedings, financial matters, decisions over Bible versions, hymn books. These kinds of things, which, yes, are necessary responsibilities, they can somehow stir our juices far more than sermons and hymns about the cross of Jesus Christ, or midweek prayer meetings where we have the incalculable privilege of approaching together the living God on the throne of the universe. We must always make sure, mustn't we, that we're excited by what we should be excited by. The privilege of being Christians, being born again, being redeemed, being saved. That's what really animates us. Yes, there are other things we need to see to. But what animates us is the privilege of being saved by grace through Jesus Christ. May it be so. Amen.